Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Is she a stand-up? Is she a writer? Is she a writer-producer? Is she an actress? Yes.
Wow.
I guess Alex Borstein is all these things. One of the things I love so much about watching the show, getting on HBO, is her performance and watching her work with other people. Because I imagine so much of the work you do is like voiceover when you're doing Family Guy, you're working by yourself. Do you guys record with the cast very often? Is it mostly just you?
We don't. In the very beginning of Family Guy, we tried to do it like a radio play. And we were all together, and we had someone at the helm kind of directing us. And it was a bit of a disaster because you can't take the time to go back and redo specific lines with everyone just sitting there waiting. And it just didn't work. And then as the show grew and, you know, Mila Kunis and Seth Green and Seth MacFarlane and me, we all have these busy schedules and crazy, you know, Mila's a movie star and Seth has an empire and MacFarlane is directing and I'm doing Getting On. So the schedule does not let us work together anymore, which it is. It's kind of lonely.
Because, I mean, we should say you guys probably know her as Lois and many other voices, the two American-sounding Asian reporter and the other parts on Family Guy. But I guess one of the things I love is – I always never thought that Mad TV got its due. And why do you think that is?
You know, it was always kind of an underling to SNL. But in some ways, I kind of liked it. I liked that we were the underdog. And I think we got our due for quite a while. We were kind of bigger in urban areas than SNL
was. It was always bigger
areas. Yeah, and I certainly felt it. I mean, if I hit the streets of New York and still do, that is, you know, my people. That's really kind of where you hear it constantly, people shouting out to Miss Swan and all these other characters from there. So, yeah, I do wish that it was still plugging away. We're actually going to get together to do a little reunion show.
When?
We will be shooting a little something next month.
Oh, my gosh. When will it go on the air?
I don't know. I think it should be pretty soon. I think it's a quick turnaround because I believe this would be like the 25th year reunion. So they wanted to mark it with this little piece that we're going to do. And Will Sasso and I are kind of working on it a little bit right now.
Oh, my God. That's so exciting.
Yeah. It'll be fun.
I'm glad I came to work today. But I want to ask you because on the show Getting On, which takes place in a geriatric care center primarily for women, and it's primarily a female cast, you and the incredible Laurie Metcalf.
Yes.
And the equally cool Niecy Nash.
Mm-hmm.
In the first episode, because I have been a fan of the British show, I love what you guys did with the stool sample stuff because there's something about that British show that, first of all, it's so unflatteringly lighted as to make your show look like it was set by Steven Soderbergh. I mean,
it seems like everybody, it's not just that we're naturally beautiful.
Well, you are naturally
okay,
beautiful.
Right.
But when you're basically around that big station with all those fluorescent lights overhead, and the recreation of that, that's basically there to look real. But every room in that British show looked like that. But as much as I like the British show, there's this sort of thing that's really evolved in the American version of Getting On, where it's really about these women sort of being very different when they're not working or they're not dealing with the case very specifically, the personal lives. We're getting to see Dawn let her guard down. And I just like, I mean, I watched all the episodes last night. Unfortunately, I haven't had a chance to see the episode for the new season yet, but I rewatched everything last night. And I just love how she's so much more inviting. I mean, she really wants DD to be part of her life now in a way that she didn't at the beginning. And she, that love affair, that kind of idolatry she has, Gemma's kind of gone away a little bit.
Mm-hmm. You know, Dawn is such a child. It's like one of the greatest things to play her. All of my favorite characters, like Miss Swan and Dawn, the thing they have in common that I love is that they're childlike. There's this bizarre, twisted innocence that they have. It's almost sick. There's almost something sick about them and delusional almost. They're such optimists. And even in the face of complete darkness, Dawn keeps running into the same wall. She keeps saying yes to Dr. James. She keeps doing whatever Laurie Metcalf's character asks in hopes that she will love her and praise her and think she's good enough. And she desperately wants to pull Dee Dee into her side and under her wing. And I think mostly she wants Dee Dee's friendship to prevent Dee Dee from getting too close to Dr. James. I think she just wants to make sure nothing of hers is taken from anyone and make sure she has something to hold on to at the end of the day. She's desperate.
But that sense, I mean, because that happens pretty early on in the first season where you just sort of see her like trying to bring her close to her so she can look over her shoulder and see that there's nothing going on behind her back.
Exactly.
But there's also this thing I love about Dawn, too, where all her reactions are slightly slower than they should be.
I'm not sure what that means.
But, you know, it's like everybody else moves really fast. It's like, and she's almost like wants to present this kind of patina professionalism where you take your time, you talk these things through. So she's almost willing things to be really slow so that when, for example, when she's making out with her new husband.
Oh, Dawn. One of the first things they told me when I was auditioning, Mark and Will, the show creators, is they said, "We just want you to always remember that Dawn is a mess, her life is a disaster, but when she's on the floor, when she is working, and when she is there at Mount Palms and taking care of those patients, that's where she is dominating. That's where she feels wholly confident and, you know, can pretend almost to be this other person. She pretends for so long that she kind of becomes that person."
That's what I'm saying. I mean, she's almost like she's acting like what a nursing professional is supposed to be like.
Yes.
And then the reactions are slightly slower because she's trying to make sure she gets the lines right.
Right.
So somebody's recording it.
Yes. She wants to not flub her character within her character.
But I just thought that was a fascinating way to play it because, again, for everybody else, it's – in fact, for Dr. James, it's almost like she doesn't think about anything. I mean, she's such a – baldly manipulative person that she's actually not very manipulative unless you want to be manipulated by her. But Dawn is really that and Niecy just sort of like gives into her instincts, but Dawn is really, you can sort of see her putting the pages down to like memorize the script and knowing what she's going to say in any given situation. I just wonder where that came from for you, that idea of make it feel almost like Dawn is acting.
Some of that was, like I said, their direction. And some of it's just once you get on the set and you're working opposite Laurie Metcalf and you're working opposite Melvin Rodriguez and having these incredible opportunities, it kind of just happened naturally. They would present just this amazing performance on the other end, and sometimes that pause or that moment is me just kind of taking in that brilliance and then deciding how will I try to see that, match it, and raise on it.
There seems to be so much for you pleasure in working with other actors, and there's a kind of a gleam that you get in your eye when mm-hmm. the stuff is really playing that's so inviting to watch.
Now, this show is – it was magic, and it's like I will start blubbering any moment. It was the most incredible experience of my life, these 3 years of – I mean, I just changed as a person going through this process, and it's just this kind of cocooning experience for me and coming out the other end of it a very different person. I think Dawn and the experience of doing this show, this sounds so cheesy, but kind of allowed me to just be more vulnerable myself, allowed me to kind of see that, I don't know, being female wasn't a detriment, that being soft or being vulnerable at times is okay. It may have just been the time in my life at the same time, but playing someone that vulnerable just left me a little window to be able to continue it within my own life.
Wow, that's really interesting to say because I feel that pleasure in performance in you, and it's something that it always attracts me as a viewer whenever I can sort of see just an actor radiating excitement and joy over a piece of material, and I see it so often in that show.
And all of us.
If it, was it immediate there?
Oh, all of us, yes. I mean, we get there in the morning. We would shoot an episode in 3 days, 3.5 days. No time. You have to be off book. Nobody's studying their lines right before you get to the set at 7 a.m.
Those are long takes, too, so you really can't do that.
And you don't leave. There's no lighting. There's no stand-in. There's no second team that comes in while they're lighting and I sit in the trailer. You're there on the set for most of the entire day, and you bounce after you finish one scene. You move to the next Patsy's office, and you continue the next. And nonstop plate spinning and the most exciting work environment I've ever been in. And challenging, too. It was the hardest thing I've ever done, but... Well, that's not true. Writing's probably – writing's the hardest. But in terms of performing, I feel like this was the most challenging thing I've ever done and the most rewarding. And, Yeah, just every second, like just wanting more takes, wanting them to not be satisfied so that we can keep doing it and keep looking across at Laurie Metcalf and having another go at it and finding something else interesting, and just loved it.
It's a treat. My guest, who has no reason to apologize for herself, is Alex Borstein. She's done so much stuff. A couple of British things alone. She's a writer-producer on Shameless and starring in the adaptation, the American adaptation, of the BBC show Getting On HBO, which is now in its final season. And it's interesting because...
I hope that's not true, by the way.
I hope it's not either. But I think it's interesting is that in almost immediately for me, the show felt different again. It's that sort of thing where the affect of the British actors, everybody's kind of playing a character in some way. And that disappears for me in the American version almost immediately. Where, again, I was saying there's kind of this, with the, maybe the exception of Dee Dee, everybody's one person in this situation and another and something else. And you were just talking about it with Dawn. And was that something that the creators talked about as the way to make it feel different from the British show?
You know, I think that anytime you adapt a show, it has to be different because you're a different human being. Once you leave that first episode, you know, sometimes you stick close to the pilot and stick close to the first few to get a running start. You can't help but make it different because your experience is different and Americans speak differently. Americans treat each other differently. Americans emote differently, allow themselves to be a little more visually vulnerable, I think. That might be a blanket statement, but... But, you know, Mark and Will did the show after losing both of their mothers, and they wanted to do something in this environment, in that arena of healthcare for the aging. And this show was already existing. They said, let's adapt this. But I think they always knew they wanted to kind of put their own spin on it based on a lot of their own experience.
And it's also very much a show, too, about actors. I mean, you see Betty Brantley hanging around the back. There's so many great performers.
Jim Squibb.
Oh, my God. Yes. Yes.
We've got Rita Moreno coming on this next season.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Really?
It's pretty exciting.
Oh.
That's one of the coolest things is meeting some of these women who have been working for as long as they have.
And these powerhouse actresses who just come in and there becomes this instant kind of chemistry because part of it, too, is just sort of the fun of seeing actresses work, and it's in a way that isn't sort of about being presentational, but about finding character.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
got to
be really cool, isn't it?
It's really cool. And realizing, you know, sitting across from June Squibb while we're working, realizing you might first look at a woman with white hair and say, that's not me, and that's years away, and that will never be me. But you just realize the second you sit down and hang out with these women, like, that is me. And I'm her. She's me. She feels like she's 25 inside still, too. Like, I have no idea. Coming on this campus, I had no idea what a college student looked like. And still, you know, and I checked a mirror and went, holy crap, that's me? But, you know, realizing that it sounds cliche, but you never feel your age ever. You never really realize you are an elderly person while you're an elderly person. And these women never presented themselves that way, never acted that way, just wanted to work, share stories from the old days. I mean, we have Anne Gilbert, who's from the Dick Van Dyke Show.
And yeah.
June Squibb, who worked with Ethel Merman and Gypsy. I mean, some of those stories, first of all, they're very filthy. I can't repeat them. But they're just amazing, these experiences that these women have had.
My guest, who refers to herself as an innocent, and mm-hmm. if you've ever seen anything she's done, you might have a hard time swallowing that, is Alex Borstein, who I think of as somebody who really finds a way to put voices across. And I don't mean just the idea you're doing voices, but as a writer, I mean, I think there's a part of you that almost always thinks in how this character, I don't mean literally sounds, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
What the character sounds like. And I wonder where that started for you.
You know, I think...
And not just the voice, but you know what I mean? That idea of an embodiment of a character, because you do it pretty fully.
I think it was like being kind of the comic relief in my family. We grew up with like a medical disorder and one of my brothers had, and in and out of hospitals and things. And I was always in the position of being the entertainer and trying to lighten the mood. And I think that's where it came from, of doing it that way. I also grew up with different language in the house and a grandmother with a thick accent and taking on her character and doing impersonations of her.
And did she laugh when you did them?
Oh, loved it.
Okay.
Absolutely loved it. And then I'd do it outside of the family to entertain. And I think it really did grow from there. And escapism, too. I think trying to be anyone but yourself, it's much easier to embody another character and do that for a while. Take a break from yourself.
It's funny because as you're saying these things, though, I just, when I see you do something, and that's one of the things I think is really hard to do in sketch comedy, when you're playing something, it's not just a caricature, but be a character specifically and immediately. And that's the kind of thing I think about for you doing. So that's why the kind of the vulnerability you're talking about in Dawn is so surprising to me, because those other characters have kind of a hard shell to them mm-hmm. in some ways. I just wonder that idea of capturing a character so quickly, almost like being a kind of a theatrical snapshot. When did that really sort of, you talk about these formative things, but when did that really click for you?
I mean, like I said, it was doing those things at a young age to make family and other people laugh.
Mm-hmm. But
then professionally, I mean, I did stand up for the first time when I was 16 years old, and it was not very funny.
Where'd you do it?
I did it in the Valley, here in California, in Los Angeles Valley.
What was the venue?
It was a place called Gallagher's on Devonshire in Northridge, in Chatsworth, California.
Okay.
It was in the bottom of a Ramada Inn hotel. It was just the closest thing to where we lived in Northridge. And I said, could I do stand-up there? And they said, well, you have to bring an adult with you because it's a bar. So my parents had to go with me, and they paid me $20 to do my set. And, you know, it was ridiculous, but it embodied like me impersonating teachers and making fun of and doing other students at the school. And I probably did my grandmother at that point, too.
Did that get a laugh when you did your grandmother?
It did get a laugh, mostly because most of the people in the audience were related to me. I had to invite my entire family, which is the only reason they paid me. It was the biggest night they had at Gallagher's. But that was like when I first learned, like, oh, wow, I could write. Writing was just I started doing that as a means to be able to perform faster, not having to wait for a play to audition for or wait for summer camp to do a play. Or, you know, it was the quickest way I could see to try to get in front of people and try to be funny and try to get people to like me, I guess, is the sad truth. But yeah, that's kind of where it was born. I think doing that set was kind of the first real. Prior to that, I had done some summer theater and plays and things like that. But that was the first time where I realized there's a power to this. Like, I enjoy persuading a room full of people to feel a certain way.
What did it feel like when you stepped onto the stage for the first time? Because you've got to remember that at Gallagher's. And you walked in and you hit that stage and that spotlight hit you in the eye.
You know, I was strangely cocky. I think it was this odd, the naivete that is a shield. You know, it's strength. I think being so young and so naive, I didn't know how scary it was. I didn't possibly think about the fact that I could fail. I didn't think that way. It was just like, oh, I'm going to get up and do this and people are going to laugh. And and of course, my family members kindly and gently laughed. You know, it started a little road that I haven't been able to. I didn't study theater. When I went to college, it's related. I actually studied rhetoric, which is the art of persuasion, which is the art of moving masses and trying to get people to feel a certain way with written words or oration. And I didn't know what I wanted to do with it. I didn't really think that acting is something I could do for a living. I wasn't sure. Maybe it was just fear or just this Jewish upbringing of like, no, you got to major in something real and have a real career and you'll dabble in that on the side. But
and the career in studying rhetoric? I mean, that really was pretending like you were going for something real when, in fact, you were basically just a philosophical precept away from acting.
I guess so. Yeah, I didn't know it at the time. I started doing advertising after college. I worked as a copywriter, which, you know, again, relies on the same tenets of rhetoric, but for very different purpose. Although, not really. We're all selling something, right? We're all just selling soap, folks.
Or pledges. We're going to take a break. My guess is actress and writer and performer and apparently stand-up and singer. She does so many things.
Well, let's take it easy.
Okay, I'm sorry. We'll save some for the break. Alex Borstein, who's starring on the terrific HBO show Getting On, is the treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
Welcome back. My guest, who for some reason seems to be abashed about being complimented.
Well,
I have no idea why, given how many ways you've proven yourself as Alex Borstein, who, of course, many of us know from her incredible vocal work on Family Guy, but is proving herself, has proven herself in great ways on the HBO series Getting On. And I guess one of the things I was thinking about that I kind of love about the show is cake turns up so often.
Cake. I do love cake. There is more cake coming in season 3.
Is there?
There is a fantastic cake that I have my way with. In many ways, I have my way with a cake.
But that to me gets to that sort of thing where that Dawn is really kind of a kid. She loves cake. Mm-hmm. And I just remember there's almost this weird kind of continuum from the first episode to the last episode of the second season, which starts off in that first episode where there's a cake where somebody's passed away.
That's right.
And then
eating a dead woman's birthday cake.
Well, yeah, sure. Why not? Okay, yeah, let's
so
do it.
So classy.
To this last episode of the last season where there's a wedding reception in a gift shop.
That's right. There's a surprise wedding and another cake. I didn't even put that together. Well, there's another one coming in the third season. And Dawn's character is actually having a bit of a medical crisis. So really the last thing she should be doing is having cake, and yet she will enjoy some cake.
But that whole childlike thing you're talking about, I mean, the way she throws herself into these relationships, it's really almost like junior high, not even high school, junior high school.
Yeah, she's like a toddler at times. I mean, I have a 7-year-old and a 3-year-old, and she is no different. I mean, there's a scene where she escapes a conversation by trying to slide down a banister. It's like, it's madness. It's just not acceptable behavior for an adult.
Well, I'd love, for example, that last scene of this last season where she's trying basically to hide in plain sight in a gift shop. Well, what adult tries to hide in a place where there's only like 2 racks?
Yes.
Really, I mean, it's not like there's like many things you can get behind. So
yeah.
That again, to me, is that whole thing, this thing we were talking about, this sort of schism, because it is this sort of thing where you like go a half a step in the other direction and it's completely tragedy.
Yeah.
And your constant awareness of that as a performer has to be kind of always on point, isn't it? I mean, you've always got to be aware of that, about
yeah,
how to play
and,
it.
And that show, every line, every bit of dialogue, every episode, every season, it walks this fine, fine line between tragedy and balls out comedy. It's we have these huge, broad moments and then these very tragic, sad, quiet, tiny moments. And finding that line was why it was the most challenging work I've ever done. And many times I'd get it completely wrong. I would.
What do you mean?
It would be like receiving sheet music, where I would look at the scene the night before, work on it, say, I got this, I got this, I got this, and then show up to the set and I would open my mouth and start a pop song and they'd say, no, this is a ballad. You read this wrong. You didn't look at the meter correctly. You got this completely wrong. And I would have to step back and say, holy, I did not even see that, and kind of see the Escher of it all, back away from it and suddenly see a very different piece of music. And many times they guided us. I mean, Laurie Metcalf and I always say that this is the best written work we've ever had to work with, and working with people who are able to craft our performances with us in a manner we've never experienced before.
But given the size of the awful things that go on at that place, a lot of it is sotto voce. And you know, you think about something like Shameless, which really is, it's farce. So it is a pop song. It's actually almost all power ballad.
Mm-hmm.
And God, you started off doing like animated shorts, right? You worked on Pinky and the Brain, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
And that really is, those are all pop songs. You just got to be basically, it's
boom,
you
boom, boom,
boom, boom. Yeah, and then you're out.
Yeah.
You must be luxuriating in the idea of this sort of thing that's really about intimacy and about contact.
Yeah. In every way. Contact through the material and verbally and actual physical
contact. Yeah, I mean, because there's so much touching. But there's got to be something reassuring in those physical touches, because those are all patients who mm-hmm. are suffering in some way, and they want to feel the confidence in Dawn's physical contact with them, don't they?
Mm-hmm. And I think Dawn uses that as a power. She doles it out when she wants someone to feel that contact, and she will withhold it if she doesn't want them to. And I think one of the reasons she does what she does, she was probably good at math and biology, but horrific at logic and horrific at retaining a real piece of information from reading any essay. And I think it was medicine, in a way, was the only thing she could really do, adapt to. But I also think she's so terrified of being alone and dying alone, and so terrified of being one of those women in that ward with no family and no one else, that karmically, perhaps she thinks if she doesn't do it on this end, that no one will be there to take care of her.
But that's the constant sort of sense of nightmare that really, I think, exists in the American version of the show more. I mean, it seems almost like a fait accompli that at some point in the British show, they're all going to end up like that. Mm-hmm. The American show is that optimism of you, like, conduct your life in the right way and you give, even though there's some ulterior motive, that you won't end up like that.
Right. The American dream. You can have it all. I also love that it highlights how screwed up our healthcare system is. And a friend of mine who is a doctor, who is an OBGYN, you know, she says that she teaches at a university, and she says the scariest thing to her is seeing the type of people now that are attracted to the medical industry. The type of people that want to be doctors is very different from the type of people that used to be. And
what's the difference?
It's people now that know how to handle red tape. People now who that feel like they can work within a system and make a system work, as opposed to someone who wanted to solve a medical puzzle, as opposed to someone who wanted to find something new through research or just working with patients and try something and broaden medicine in a way. And now it's just people who are better at working within a system and learning how to get through red tape with all of the insurance companies and how you have to do it. And it's not just that they're not going to make as much money, which is partially true, but it's mostly just a lot of the true artists can't handle the business side of it, can't handle the red tape of it and the nonsense of the insurance and not being able to prescribe what they want to prescribe because of insurance situations. It's got to be so frustrating for these people.
Well, some of the turns of the show, too, is really turning the three leads into victims of this inability to sort of surf that sea of red tape, mm-hmm. or disinterest and really want to do that. Finally, at least for you guys, for Dawn and Dee Dee, it's about really wanting to make a difference in these women's lives.
I think for Dee Dee, she really wants to make a difference in these women's lives and really listens and cares. I think for Dawn, I think she's like the most selfish altruist on the planet.
But there still is. Even in that selfishness, she's still, by ministering to these women, is making them feel better about themselves.
Yes.
So they're not getting
that's true.
That sort of that kind of infantile narcissist of her that she's basically being reflected in their responses.
Yeah.
They're not getting that.
That's true.
So I think it skirts, again, and a half a step to the left, it's the stuff of tragedy.
And I think you do find, if you've ever had a hospital stay, some of the best nurses you have are the ones that are a little more clipped, that don't care too much. When they care too much, sometimes they'll get very involved in your BS and you know, not be as objective as they should be when you say what your pain level is and doling out more pills. And sometimes you kind of want someone who's a little bit of a marm and that's going to hold back a little bit to be the one tending to your care. So maybe the mix is good. You want Dee Dee and Dawn on the same shift is what you want.
Yeah, that's what they call in Asia balance. It's the treatment. My guest, for the first time anybody's used the word marm on the show before, is Alex Borstein. That's a very interesting turn of phrase. She's done so much stuff. We're talking about her terrific work in front of the camera on the show Getting on HBO. What's that like for you, being in front of the camera? Because you've done so much stuff behind the camera. I mean, you've quite accomplished. Do you feel more like a writer than an actor? I mean, what makes the most sense to you when you're doing it?
It's such an interesting question. People always ask, like, do you consider yourself more of a writer? And
I guess I don't know what feels the best as you're doing. Is it whatever you're doing at the time, or is it one that feels slightly more accommodating than the other?
Performing feeds the monster better. Performing is a quicker fix. Performing is a ribeye steak and a loaded baked potato and a piece of chocolate cake or a hot pie with melty ice cream on it. That's performing. Writing is a leaner, more difficult meal. It's going to be, you're going to feel full at the end of it, but it's not as decadent an experience. It's just a lot harder, and although you feel more powerful, sitting behind the computer before anyone gives you notes or messes with what you're doing, you are the master of your domain. It's your universe. You can ruin it or do anything you like to it. And that's a very powerful feeling. As an actor, you are at someone else's disposal and they're controlling the universe and you maybe can name your own star and that's about it. But the actual feeling of performing, especially getting on, there's just nothing like that.
Well, it's funny because so much of medical stuff, even in comedy, is finally about the idea of glamorizing danger. You know, that idea that something's about to happen that's going to be life or death. And it's a more distended look at that world than getting on. I mean, it's like the show doesn't begin or end in any one episode. I mean, you really have to watch them all.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all part of this fabric. And there's something about that use the word decadent. I feel like there's almost something decadent about most medical shows.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of way that they use physical trauma as a way to sort of bait the hook for the audiences.
Right.
And this is really a show about listening.
Well, this is a show that says no one gets out alive. On ER, on Grey's Anatomy, on House, they find magic. They find a magic cure and they solve the puzzle and someone leaves better than they came in. And on this show, this is about holding someone's hand as they take their, you know, long day's journey into night. It's, we are all going to die. And it's hard to look at, it's hard to accept, but this show, you know, rather than someone preventing that from happening, we are just holding the hand and moving towards the light.
But by taking us behind the scenes, showing us what these women are like when they're not dealing with patients, I think the show, and again, for me, that's the break between the British show and the American, it does sort of offer that kind of optimism of, by just building a kind of ad hoc family, you can find something that makes this slow march into oblivion endurable. And not only that, but actually pleasant.
Yeah. You know, they are a twisted little family, absolutely. I feel like Jenna is the matriarch and Dawn is the older sister and Dee Dee has come on as the younger sister. And which also, you don't get to see three well-crafted female characters that often on any show. And then you're surrounded by all these older women that are these, like you said, part of this fabric, this brilliant fabric. And yeah, we definitely, I think we're all clinging to each other, knowing we're all going to end up on the other side of this bed at one point, and we're clinging to each other till we get there.
Had you seen much of the British show before?
No, you know, it's funny. I was developing a different show for the BBC.
Oh, what was that show?
It was based on another British show, something that was also by Paul Abbott, who did Shameless, and that's how I met him. And this was another show he had done years ago called Linda Green.
Oh, man.
And I tried to redevelop that and was working with him on that when getting on at the same time. While I was clickety-clacking at my laptop, I saw on Deadline or something like that, and Will Sheffer and Mark Olson developing Getting On. What's this now? And I clicked on the British version. They showed a clip. And I started bawling. I was like, I want to be a part of that. I want that. I finished my script. I turned it in.
And what happened with that script?
Nothing happened with it. I think it was originally for Fox, and they passed on it.
What were you doing? Where was it going to be set in the States?
It was going to be set in South Boston. And it was going to be very different than the UK version, but it stemmed from that. So, but then a few months later, all of a sudden, I got this email saying, we'd like you to audition for Getting On. And I couldn't believe it was the same thing I'd looked at months ago while I was writing. I just had a baby. I wasn't going to do any work. And I was like, up in Seattle, I'd had a baby. And I put myself on tape for Dawn. And that was October. Then when I got back to LA in November, went in to read with Laurie Metcalf. And here we are. I don't know if that answers the question.
No, it does answer the question. Because I was wondering how you got involved with Shameless. That really does answer that. And so then you developed a relationship with
Shameless. I got involved with because I had met John Wells while working with another writer named Scott Frank on developing something else.
What were you working with Scott on?
We were going to maybe do this. They were doing this thing together that I had contributed a bit to and was going to work on with them that never made it. But that's how I met John Wells. And then when John was doing Shameless, he said, hey, do you want to write on this? And so that's how that started. It was kind of an interesting – it's all fabric.
Life really is
a giant weave, girl.
Well, you're not looking at my head as you say that. That's fine. But
I'm looking at mine.
Well, it's funny because you talked about Paul Abbott, and then there's John Wells, and all these things. There's so many parts of your life that sort of seems like that these things, when you step back, they all in their way are kind of connected because, you know, obviously when you were working on Mad TV, that was at Fox, and that's probably how you met Seth MacFarlane.
Yes, it is.
And so these things, one role leads to another in a lot of ways.
And then Family Guy led to meeting Dan Palladino, whose wife Amy Sherman Palladino did Gilmore Girls.
And tell your Gilmore Girls story, which I'm sure you've told once or twice before, but it's a great story. I love this story.
I was cast as Sukie St. James, and it was when we didn't know if Mad TV was coming back or not the next season.
Oh, that's why you did it? Oh, okay.
So I auditioned for it. I got it. And then I was told I'd be able to do both, and then at the last minute, Fox was like, nope. So Melissa McCarthy replaced me on Gilmore Girls, and then I did a different part. So
eventually, yeah.
I did a couple different parts on that show, which was really fun. I did that Drella, the harpist, and then Miss Celine, 80-something-year-old stylist.
And again, the specificity of these things. I mean, it's just, I wonder as a performer if you like the idea of finding a character or if it's there as soon as you see it on the page. You like the idea? Because in watching Getting On, we get to see these really sort of beautiful, subtle shape that you've given to Dawn over the course of the show. Like that excitement of just either with one of these men she's with, just some of the way her eyes open a little bit wider when she sees them, or if it's more fun to pick up something when you're doing Family Guy, especially now that you're not writing anymore.
I actually am. I'm back there writing.
You're back writing again?
I am consulting again.
Oh.
I'll be there tomorrow.
Oh, my gosh. Because you clearly don't have enough stuff to do. But
the truth is, I like the combo of it.
Yeah?
And I think I'm so lucky that I know – knowing Amy Sherman Palladino and her knowing me, when she writes for me, I think she knows some of the spices that I use, and so she's able to kind of craft a recipe that she knows I'm going to have the ingredients for. And same with Mark and Will after a few seasons on Getting On, and at Family Guy too. Like the guys and girl in the writer's room, whether I'm there or not, they kind of know, oh, Borstein will get this. Like this will be totally in her wheelhouse. But when you work with a new person, it's that excitement. It's like sex with someone new for the first time. It's not knowing what are they going to like? What are they going to respond to? And maybe I'll try this. And so it's fun. It's fun to broaden out to people you haven't worked with before and do pieces that written by someone that you don't know is kind of fun that way too.
Because I got to wonder as the last question, if you were nervous in those first few episodes of Getting On, when it was a new team of people you were working with, a whole new team of people as a matter of fact, and you were finding the character as they were finding out things about you, what that was like. I mean, was that kind of loss of control to some extent like a really great thing as much as it was terrifying?
That is such a great question because the truth is I was terrified every day.
Yeah?
I never relaxed on that set. It was terrifying to me. I sweat more than I ever have. I kind of obsessively put lotion on my hands and it was very disconcerting and scary, and I always felt like I'm about to be fired. I'm going to be fired. I don't know what I'm doing. Do they know? I don't know. Okay, let's see what happens. It was always living kind of in this, which I think I liked. I think it was really exciting and kind of like going through a haunted house every day, not knowing when someone would jump out. It was thrilling.
Do you like those episodes now? Can you watch them, those early episodes?
Yeah, I can watch them now. It's very hard to watch stuff too soon. Like if I have to go and do ADR, any post-production, which I will have to do on Monday, it's so hard for me to see it on the screen, especially that large.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It's so weird because whatever you're doing on the inside, it never looks the same on the outside. It's like hearing your voice on a recording for the first time. It's, you know, you think you're squinting slightly and you look at the screen and there's nothing happening with your face. You think you are making sexy eyes at somebody across the room and it looks like you're having a stroke. Like I was not able to control my face to the extent that I thought I could. So it was very alarming and uncomfortable. But after time passes, I'm able to kind of see it through different eyes.
I'm glad you've got some distance on it because it's terrific work. It really is a great performance, Alex. It really, really is. I mean, it's just watching this evolution and just how now she doesn't do this thing anymore where her shoulders are kind of just tense up, which I guess we're now saying maybe came from some of the tension you were feeling at the beginning of the performance. Just to sort of see this movement, I mean, this very subtle kind of maturation in this performance has really been a wonderful thing, and I hope you take some pleasure in it.
I have taken more pleasure than I deserve.
Oh, my God. Okay, well, you've got to come back because this has been too much fun. Please come back.
I absolutely will be back.
My guest, who apparently has way too much free time, is Alex Borstein, who's the voice of many people, including Lois on Family Guy, and is now as a writer back on the show again.
Yes.
Yeah. And starring and getting on HBO and doing the treatment. I can't thank you enough for doing this. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Our recording engineer who also mixes the show is Kat Ure. It's edited by Blake Veit, who's the associate producer. I'm just going to go home and go to sleep. It's the treatment. To catch up on past episodes of the treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.